From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, psychiatrist Dr. Gail Saltz discusses her new book, The Power of Different, The Link Between Disorder and Genius. Comic legend Bob Newhart reflects on his career and his beloved TV show, Newhart. And singer-songwriter Michael Bolton talks about his new CD, Songs of Cinema. But first, it's been a busy few weeks for the Trump administration, from the drama surrounding the Republicans' failure to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act and the Trump administration's alleged ties to Russia, to the hearings of Supreme Court judge nominee Neil Gorsuch, who, according to our next guest, has ties to a Republican activist behind voter suppression efforts. Ari Berman is the senior contributing writer for The Nation magazine and author of the book Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Good to have you back, even though I have no idea where to start.
Good to see you. A lot going on in the world.
There's so much going on. I suspect I should start with the defeat that Mr. Trump and Mr. Ryan suffered. Without coloring the question to begin our conversation, what do you make of what happened?
Well, I think it's amazing that for 7 years they ran on this principle of repealing and replacing Obamacare. They got these huge majorities. They got a president who supports it. And they didn't even have a vote. So it's just amazing that this was their biggest priority, and they couldn't even come close to getting it done.
What do you think this means for the president? Did he learn a lesson? Is he about to dig his heels in? Does he want revenge? I mean, what's your read on how he is ultimately going to respond to this?
Do you think the president learns lessons?
Well,
I'm just asking questions. I think he's a pretty fully formed human at this point.
Yeah.
And I think we have to assume that the way he acts is the way he acts. Now, he should have learned a lesson. Mm-hmm. The first lesson he should have learned is don't do unpopular stuff. Mm-hmm. He wasn't elected to repeal Obamacare. I mean, who knows exactly why he was elected? But I think one of the things that Obamacare did, people are unhappy with it, but I think it enshrined healthcare as an idea of a basic right. Mm-hmm. That you have a right to be covered if you have a pre-existing condition. You have the right to stay on your parents' plan until you're 26. You have the right to some basic coverage. And just getting rid of that altogether was jarring for people. And so Trump, I think, was caught in two places. He was caught with the right flank wanting all of it gone, mm-hmm. and the moderate flank saying, actually, we like a lot of stuff in Obamacare. And so I think that's what they didn't realize. I think they thought, yeah, maybe we'll lose a few people, but this bill that they ended up unveiling, which really wasn't a Trump bill, mm-hmm. it was more of a Paul Ryan bill, was the worst of both worlds. It didn't repeal Obamacare, but it made all the people who like parts of Obamacare unhappy as well.
In retrospect, why then do you think they were so hell-bent on pushing this healthcare thing through so early in the process?
Because they talked about it so much. Yeah. I mean, they made opposition to Obamacare such a big issue. I mean, they voted more than 40 times to repeal it. So they couldn't turn around and say, we're not going to do it. But I don't know why Trump delegated the whole process to the House, because Paul Ryan.
Well, I think I get that. I think I get that. Maybe I get my sense is because he doesn't know what he's doing.
Of course, he doesn't know what he's doing.
He doesn't know how the legislative process works. So he let them run it because he didn't know how to push it through.
Well, and he's not an effective horse trader because of that. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, whatever you make of that photo of the Freedom Caucus mm-hmm. of the White House, where it's just a bunch of white men. Mm-hmm. It feels like a scene out of 1920. Mm-hmm. A bunch of white men at the White House. They had specific concerns they wanted to address. They had policy concerns with the bill. And Trump can't talk about that. So back in the day when you had someone like LBJ, mm-hmm. the reason he was such an effective horse trader is because he understood the intricacies of legislation. He said, you know, I'll take a little bit of this and I'll take a little bit of that and we'll get a bill that works. Trump can't do that because he doesn't understand the policy.
But he wrote the book, The Art of the Deal. He wrote the book.
I mean, if you believe the news accounts of these meetings, all he's talking about is winning. I mean, the only policy is winning. And so if you're not on board with the policy of winning, yeah. then he doesn't really have anything to offer you.
We could talk, you know, ad infinitum, ad nauseum, about what this says about Paul Ryan as a Speaker of the House. But what does it say about the people around Mr. Trump?
Well, look who's around the president.
Yeah.
Steve Bannon, Kellyanne Conway. These are not people that are going to temper the president's worst impulses. Mm-hmm. These are either enablers or they're people with such radical, crazy ideas that they're going to send the ship sinking. I mean, when Steve Bannon says that he wants to get rid of the administrative state, I mean, you can't run a government. What is the government if not an administrative state? And so they're just killing the government by attrition here. The fact that there's nobody at the State Department, the fact that there's nobody at the Justice Department except at the highest levels, the fact that the whole government remains unfilled. On the one hand, you could say it's just incompetence. On the other hand, you could say this is Steve Bannon's vision. Mm-hmm. Remember when Grover Norquist said he wanted to make government so small you could drown it in a bathtub? Mm-hmm. Well, this is government has just disappeared. I mean, there's no government to drown in a bathtub because nothing's being filled in the first place. And so I think it's very worrisome that there's very few people who seem like they can relate to Trump, that they can temper his worst impulses. You have a guy like Reince Priebus as chief of staff, but he doesn't really have the power to stand up to the president.
Yeah. You and I have been progressives for a long time, and we've seen plenty of examples, a litany of examples where Democrats can mess up a good thing. What's your advice to Democrats about how to move forward after this non-vote?
Well, I think people have to be realistic. Yeah. Republicans still have big majorities. Uh-huh. So a lot of bad stuff is going to get passed. This was an extreme bill on a very contentious issue, but I think other stuff is going to happen. And by the way, healthcare is going to be weakened in other ways. Mm-hmm. The Trump administration is still in charge of a lot of things and can just kill this bill through negligence. So I don't think that we should believe that somehow this means that the resistance has won. I think what it does show is there's a value in resistance. That don't overthink it. Sometimes you just have to say no and put a line in the sand. And I think this was a really powerful example of that. And so there was a lot of talk at the beginning of Trump's presidency. Can we work with him? You know, can we cut deals? Should we pick and choose? And I think now they're realizing that if his whole agenda is going to be this extreme, then there's not going to be a whole lot of picking and choosing.
But the flip side of that is these stories you keep reading about whether or not the White House, the Trump administration, now recognizes that to get some stuff done, it might be wise of them to cross the aisle and do some deals with Democrats.
Maybe on a few issues.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe on infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Maybe on jobs. Maybe on trade. But most of Trump's agenda is going to be a non-starter on foreign policy, on immigration, on taxes. You're not going to see very many Democrats go along with it.
So the Democrats, speaking of Democrats in the Senate, were able to push back this new Gorsuch vote. Procedural move, it's happened before.
Yeah.
But what's your sense of what ultimately happens if and when, as many of us believe, he in fact is confirmed?
Well, this is a tremendously important fight. I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that how unprecedented this whole process is, that Merrick Garland should have been sitting on the Supreme Court right now. There should have been no vacancy that we're discussing. And the obstruction by the Republicans became normalized. It became normalized during the 321 days that Merrick Garland sat and waited for a hearing and didn't get one. So the fact that Democrats even showed up to Neil Gorsuch's hearing meant they were showing him more respect than Republicans showed Merrick Garland. There was a really extraordinary piece by Jeff Flake, Republican senator from Arizona, where he said, "We treated both of President Obama's nominees fairly." Leaving out that there was a third nominee, Merrick Garland.
Who never got a hearing. Yeah.
So I think Republicans set themselves up for a situation where, in my opinion, Democrats should have no choice but to block Neil Gorsuch. But based on how things are going, you have to assume that he's going to go through, but not without a fight.
Well, I hear your point about blocking him based on the principle, and I don't disagree with that. I guess the question is whether or not he is the best that they're going to get. I mean, this guy could have been someone else. And if this is the best you're going to get, and you know, number two, this isn't the only bite at the apple that Trump is going to get likely when it comes to a Supreme Court nominee, how nuclear do you want to go on this first guy?
Well, I don't think he's the best that Democrats could have gotten. I think Gorsuch is a kind of guy who's very smooth, who's very polished,
you don't think that Trump could have nominated somebody a lot more conservative?
I think he is extremely conservative.
Okay.
He just doesn't seem like
okay,
it.
Okay, I got it.
And I think it was a brilliant pick.
Okay.
I think this is the one thing, in my opinion, that the Trump administration did well, was to pick Neil Gorsuch. I think partly because they outsourced the process to the Federalist Society, to the Heritage Foundation, that has a lot of experience. The right cares about judges. Mm-hmm. They've been very good at doing this over a 40 to 50 year period. But the point is, he seems very reasonable. He's kind of straight out of central casting. He made a lot of lame dad jokes before the Senate. He was a very personable guy. But if you look at his whole background, he's extremely conservative. And he did a lot of what John Roberts did. He said, remember when Roberts said, "I'm just going to be an umpire. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to call balls and strikes. And then when Roberts got on the court, he gutted the Voting Rights Act. He signed on to the Citizens United decision, giving us unregulated, unlimited corporate money. So many radical opinions, one after another. And I think that Gorsuch is going to be that way, too. He's going to seem like a guy who's very reasonable, but he's going to carry out a very extreme far-right agenda. And so could it have been worse? Absolutely. But I don't think we should believe that he's going to be any kind of moderate or centrist on the court.
To your book, out now in paperback, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, you've started to go down this path already. Let me just push you a little further down the road. What happens? Where are we in the fight to save, or put another way, to restore that part of the Voting Rights Act that's now been gutted?
So in 2013, the Supreme Court ruled that those states with the longest history of discrimination no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. That meant that 14 states had new voting restrictions in effect for the first time in 2016. We just got out of the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. These restrictions, in my opinion, had a big impact, requiring strict forms of ID, closing down polling places, cutting early voting, purging the voting rolls, disenfranchising ex-felons. This kept tens of thousands of people from the polls in places like Wisconsin and North Carolina, and didn't get much attention. Now we're going forward, and the problem looks like it's going to get worse. Mm. You have Donald Trump saying 3 to 5 million people are voting illegally, which isn't just a lie. It's a lie that then lays the groundwork for more voter suppression. You have him saying he's going to have a presidential committee to study this. They're probably going to come out with lots of bad recommendations on the subject matter. Already this year, there have been 68 bills introduced in 27 states to make it harder to vote. So a lot of people are missing this story, but both on the national level and at the state level, voter suppression efforts are only getting worse.
Ari's book, out now in paperback, is called Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. He's a fine writer for The Nation magazine, and I'm always honored to have his insights on this program. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. For decades, psychologists have explored how some people with mental health challenges become extraordinary achievers despite being labeled different. Best-selling author and psychiatrist Dr. Gail Saltz says the unique wiring of every brain can be a source of strength and productivity. She outlines her arguments in her new book, The Power of Different, The Link Between Disorder and Genius. Dr. Saltz, good to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we say minds that are wired differently, we mean what?
Well, in this book, I'm really addressing various mental health issues as well as learning disabilities. Really, I do want to say that to some degree, all of our minds are wired differently. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's some data that'll be coming out soon to really look at, quote, normal brains and show the tremendous variation that exists amongst brains. So we usually think, oh, it's black or it's white, you're different or you're not. But really, there's great differences. But sometimes differences arise to the point that they cause suffering in life, that they cause such a challenge, like a mental health diagnosis mm-hmm. or a learning disability.
But for those persons that don't end up suffering in that way and yet are different,
yes,
or in some ways deficient, how do they overcome that?
So what I try to point out, because this is most important, is first of all, you've got to acknowledge there's something going on that's causing you suffering, mm-hmm. because that's how you get an evaluation and that's how you get treatment. And you do want treatment, because treatments work for all of these issues mm-hmm. very well, and it helps to set you back on the track. But even if you are suffering tremendously, what I also want people to understand is the very hard wiring that causes you to have this difference, that causes the suffering, is often connected to a very particular strength that is also hardwired in. Mm-hmm. That actually, if you can become aware of, and this is particularly important for, say, parents of kids who are struggling, if you can become aware of that strength and play to that strength, it can often lead to tremendous success.
Why do we tend to first see then the deficiency or the weakness versus the strength?
Well, I would say because we are searching for things that are problems. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of nation we are, if you think about it, right?
Yeah.
And we're very focused on fixing problems. And that's understandable to some degree. But when people are struggling, we tend not to think, oh, maybe they have something extraordinarily wonderful about them. So for example, when you get a diagnosis of autism, most parents are very distraught. Mm-hmm. That's understandable. But it is not their tendency to think, what is my child doing when they maybe are lining up something or have some particular spatial relation ability, or they seem to be able to memorize that book? What might we be able to use those strengths toward to really help my child exceed and succeed? Yeah. Actually, many of these problems, mood issues, attention deficit disorder, dyslexia, anxiety disorders, they are connected to things like extraordinary original thought, yeah, high creativity, pattern recognition. It depends on what we're talking about.
Yeah. I hear you encouraging people to make sure that they first acknowledge that the deficiency, that the challenge exists. I hear
yes.
that. And yet, I know that there are persons oftentimes who don't want to know that.
Yes.
And even if they know it, they don't want it on their child's record. Because
yes.
there's no guarantee that my child is going to grow up to be Sir Richard Branson,
right,
who overcame his deficiencies.
Correct.
But it's going to be on your record. And if that follows you, then...
Yes, the concern is stigma.
Yeah.
And it is really sad, but it is true that in 2017, we still stigmatize these kinds of issues. And what I'm hoping to get across to people is what a mistake that is. I mean, if you told me you had diabetes or you told mm-hmm. me you had heart disease, I would not say, wow, well, you know, I don't really want anything to do with you and I don't want that mm-hmm. on my record, et cetera. The brain is an organ like any other organ. And when it has something going on that is a trouble, a problem, it is not the person's fault. It is not a moral deficiency. It is a biological issue that mm-hmm. needs a treatment. And we have to start seeing that not only that is the case, which is that people shouldn't be ashamed because this is not something they caused or they mm-hmm. did or they did to their child, but that the brain is very plastic. It keeps changing as time goes on. And when you intervene early with treatment, you make neurologic changes that can actually alleviate that person's suffering and to some degree be protective and help them to not relapse. So the brain, unlike other organs, mm-hmm. does keep changing, which is why it's so important to step in and do something about it. And lastly, that you might be missing the boat here, that your child or yourself or anybody you love mm-hmm. may have some real ability that you're not looking at, you're not getting tested for, you're not, I mean, who's to say that your child won't be the next Richard Branson? Mm-hmm. I realize not everybody can
sure.
be,
sure.
but probably many more people can be succeeding if they didn't feel so stigmatized and their self-esteem weren't so torn apart by feeling that they have something they have to hide and it's terrible mm. and they can't seek help.
Is there a link, though, between disorder and genius?
Absolutely, and that's really what yeah. I'm trying to point out. The phenomenon is called the U-shaped curve, meaning people who are actually highly creative and have extraordinary ability are more likely to have a little mental illness mm-hmm. than people who have no mental illness or than people with severe mental illness. So I'm not saying that people who are, you know, very, very ill, especially mm-hmm. if they're untreated, are going to be able to take whatever innate ability they have and use it. So that's why I want you to get treatment.
Sure.
But I am saying that if you looked at all of the iconic geniuses in history, the Hemingways, the Van Goghs, the Abraham Lincolns, the Albert Einsteins, they all had a mental health diagnosis. And if you removed all of those people from history who yeah. had mental health issues, you would have no history. So I think it's really important that people understand that yes, there's, and I give you the data in here to support that really having one of these issues actually may mean that you have an ability that even people who don't have these issues, you might have that
yeah.
ability.
Does the overabundance of gift or skill or talent in one area automatically equate to an under?
So I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
it's not like, oh, we shorted you here,
yeah,
so
yeah.
you get to have here.
Right.
But the way the brain is wired and connected, it is often the case that, so for example, with dyslexia,
right.
there is something going on in the left hemisphere of the brain that makes it difficult for you to process words and therefore be able to comprehend and read them.
Mm-hmm.
But there seems to be something because of that connection that's also connected to the right hemisphere that is amplified and means you have better spatial relations abilities, perhaps, than other people.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, I talk about a doctor in here, a Dr. Beryl Benesarath, who discovered the way to diagnose Down syndrome in utero.
Mm-hmm.
And she could see this because things popped out to her on ultrasound and radiograph from a visual spatial relations side mm-hmm. that other people couldn't see. And that's because she had severe dyslexia. So the wiring that is present in one part that may cause a deficit also is connected to other areas that actually may provide a relative strength, a huge strength in some instances. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you talked about Richard Branson. I mean, having ADD means you have difficulty regulating your concentration, but it also means that you have a very high flow of ideas, often divergent, unusual, creative ideas. And when it comes in big bursts like that, because you're imagining a lot, because you can't concentrate on whatever the arithmetic that was put in front of you, you often innovate at a very high level, and you're impulsive. So you're willing to take the risk of really taking those innovative ideas and making them happen. That gives you an edge, and that's why a lot of CEOs or high-level entrepreneurs and creative businesses do actually have ADD.
I always seem to note a particular humanity and sensitivity that they may have, even if they're wrestling with certain mental issues.
Yes.
I think of Dr. King, and most folk don't know this, but Dr. King, great leader that he was, suffered from mania. But it's that mania, the researchers now believe, that led to the sort of radical empathy, not just empathy, but the radical empathy that he had for other people.
You are correct.
Does that make sense to you?
It's actually, not only does it make sense to me, but it's true.
Yeah.
And that is because for some of these illnesses, emotional centers of the brain are, let's say, overly vigilant, on high alert. You have high empathy, and you have an ability to scan the emotion of others and stand in their shoes and really read them in a certain kind of way that's very, comes out as very intuitive, let's say. But in addition to that, if you have suffered with one of these problems, so for instance, if you had mania, that meant you also probably had depressions. So if you have suffered through that and you have part of your package as how that felt, you often have a unique ability to sympathize with others, for others. It gives you a resilience, having made it through that, and an ability to really tap into and be very emotionally attuned to other sufferings.
Maybe what the world needs is a little bit more mania.
Maybe so.
But I digress on that point.
If it brings, so.
If anything that brings about more empathy, I'm all for.
Yeah.
The book is called The Power of Different, The Link Between Disorder and Genius by Dr. Gail Saltz. Dr. Saltz, thank you for the work, and good to have you on this program.
Thank you so much for having me.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Bob Newhart has been delighting audiences with his comedy for more than 50 years now. The final season of his show, Newhart, was just released on DVD, and it includes the surprise ending that's still considered one of the best in all of TV history. Before we start our conversation, here now to refresh your memory is that famous scene from the Newhart series finale.
Honey, honey, wake up. You won't believe the dream I just had. What? But don't you want to hear about it?
All right, Bob. What is it?
Well, I was an innkeeper in this crazy little town in Vermont.
That was one of the best endings ever.
And my wife's idea.
Yeah, your wife's idea.
She came up with it, yeah.
Wow.
We were in the sixth year. The show went 8 years. That's the eighth year.
Yeah.
And the sixth year, I was kind of unhappy with CBS. They were moving us around.
Yeah.
And putting in shows in front of us and behind us. And so we were at a Christmas party. And we were waiting to have a picture taken with the guest, people's home we were at. And I said, you know, honey, I said, I think this is going to be the last year of the show. And she said, you ought to end it in a dream sequence. Because everything was so crazy. It was so surreal. It was, the maid was an heiress. And then we had Larry, Darrell, and Daryl, who were, I felt, straight out of Deliverance, you know. What they were doing in Vermont, I have no idea. And I said, oh, that's a great idea. So Suzanne was there, and we told her, she said, if I'm in Timbuktu, I'll be back for that. She said, I'll be back in a New York minute.
Yeah. You and I were talking before we came on, and I was saying to you that in some ways,
Speaking of Suzanne Pleshette, you're the last man standing. Mary Fran is gone. Tom Poston is gone. You're 88 this year?
I'll be 88 in September.
88 in September, yeah.
Still fooling them.
Still fooling them, still getting them laugh. Still making them laugh, rather. But, like, what do you make of the fact? I mean, you've been so blessed. So, I mean, that's my word, not yours, but you're still.
No, I feel the same way. I've been very blessed. We're talking about the first album I made. It was the very first album, a comedy record.
And you were still in Chicago then?
I was in Chicago.
Still living at your parents' home at the time.
That's right.
Yeah, I remember this.
And we recorded in Houston, Texas.
Yeah.
And we thought it might just go, you know, maybe 10,000 records.
Yeah.
And it went crazy.
Yeah.
All over the country. And it went to number one, then the number two album. I had the number one and number two album. Mm-hmm. Then the number two album went to number one. Mm-hmm. So then I had the number one and number two album for like 20 weeks, but I didn't even know it. I didn't know I had that record. So my daughter, her husband was in the music business, she called me up and she said, "Dad, you know, you just lost a record." And I said, "What was that?" She said, "Well, Guns N' Roses has had the number one and number two album longer than you had it." And I said, "Well, at least it went to a friend."
Yeah. You know?
Axe and I, we talk all the time. I was on the cell
just
phone
on the
with Axe.
Yeah. So you're still doing what? A dozen shows a year?
About
10 shows a year?
10, 12 shows a year.
And
stand up.
Stand up, yeah. And like, what does that consist of? Is it classic stuff? Is it new stuff? Is it a mixture of classic stuff and new stuff?
Like, it's a mixture. I'll do like one or two of the from the album.
From the album, yeah, sure.
And then the rest is all just observations on this crazy world that we live in.
Yeah.
And it's true. The only way to survive is to laugh.
To laugh, yeah.
That's the only way. You know. And my wife and I, we're married 54 years. We were married in January, 54 years. And someone once asked me, what's the reason? I said, I think laughter has a lot to do with how long a marriage lasts. You know, it's true among comedians. Jack Benny was married to Mary for a long time. George Burns, Buddy Hackett. I mean, there's something about laughter and the longevity of a marriage.
Yeah. What do you make of the fact that stuff that you did on record 50 years ago still kills in front of an audience a half a century later?
Luck.
Yeah.
I didn't plan it, you know.
But the joke, I mean, you don't tell jokes, you tell stories. But the material must, I mean, it says something about the material.
Well, because it's still true. I mean, the first, I had the driving instructor.
Mm-hmm. Driving instructor, funny stuff. Yeah.
Then I had the submarine commander, which is about being in service, and that still exists.
Yeah.
And then I had Abe Lincoln, you know, talking to his press agent, and I mean, that's even more prevalent than was 50 years ago.
Yeah. I'm trying to imagine Abe Lincoln talking to Sean Spicer, but that's another conversation for another time.
He'd get mad at him.
Yeah, I'm sure. Which leads me to this. If you have done it, I have never seen you do it. You don't really toil in political stuff in your stand-up.
No.
Why have you avoided that, number one? Because it seems to me that nowadays these Trump jokes are writing themselves.
Yeah. He's. Well, you lose half your audience. That's one reason. Very simple.
Okay, it makes sense to me. Yeah.
No, I never got into that. I didn't feel that was my role.
Yeah.
To convince people of the way I felt. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, because they like me or in a television series or they enjoy my albums. That's no reason to vote for a person I'm going to vote for. I just never felt that was my.
Yeah. Since you were here, so it's been a great conversation so far, but now we're getting to the fun stuff here.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Because when you were last here.
What was this?
As soon as that came out of my mouth, I said, I walked into that joke, chin up, booty out. I just walked in, chin up, man. Yeah, you got to be careful talking to these comedians, man, especially legends like Bob Newhart. What I was trying to get to, Mr. Newhart, was that when you last sat in that chair, the Chicago Cubs were not the world champions that they are, and now they get to start a new season.
That's right.
With that distinction, you have been a lifelong Cubs fan.
That's right. That's
where
right.
were you? Just take the time, set it up. Just tell me, where were you? How'd you process it? How'd you feel about it? You've been living with this your whole life.
I was 16 years old in Chicago, mm-hmm. and the Cubs won 1945. The Cubs won the National League pennant. And they had this big parade down LaSalle Street, and they all were riding in convertibles and waving. And I was a 16-year-old mm-hmm. kid, you know, waving at Stan Hack or Phil Cavaretta, and that was 71 years ago, and it was in 1945. Now, 1945 was the end of World War II, and most able-bodied men were off to war, which was the last time the Cubs won the National League pennant. All the able-bodied men were off to war. So I waited 71 years, and then I got to see. Yep, then I got to see the Cubs win the pennant.
Yeah,
I mean the tweeting started. I was at home and I was watching. It was a Dodger game, mm-hmm. and the Cubs were down. It was like the bottom of the eighth, and the Dodgers were ahead, 5-3, mm-hmm. 5-3. So the Cubs are up. Now the guys get on base, they hit a home run. The Cubs were ahead 6-5. Now, bottom of the ninth, and they bring in Chapman, right? 105 miles an hour, mm-hmm. he throws the ball. He strikes out the side. So I sent a tweet to one of the people I knew in the Cub organization. I said, look, I'm 87 years old, I can't take this, you know. Will you please have them score more runs? Yeah. So they told the Cub players, yeah, as a favor to Bob, would you mind scoring more runs? Now, I do an impression of, I said 105 miles an hour. I do an impression of batting against Chapman, right?
Yeah.
105 miles an
hour. Yeah.
Okay, come on, baby. Let's see what you got. Bang. Let me see what you got, baby. He hasn't thrown it yet. What the?
So how then did you process? So that's the Dodgers series, I went to two of those games. All right. So how did you process the final round where these guys are in Chicago, have a couple chances to close it out, and they can't?
I know.
How'd you handle that?
Not well. No, I tweeted every time the Cubs won. They sent me a W flag.
Yeah.
And we would take a picture with the game in the background when the
right.
Cubs won. But I was sure when the Cubs were down two games, I said, it's over. Okay, it's, you know. And then they went to Cleveland and they won it. And it was incredible.
Yeah, in remarkable fashion.
Yeah, and I'm waiting for the day when they say, we've got to break up the Cubs, you know. It's like the Yankees, you know,
yeah.
Break them up.
Got to break them up.
Everybody knows they're going to win.
Yeah. That would be someday.
That would be someday.
Yeah. All right. The final season of Newhart is now available on DVD. Mr. Newhart, come back anytime, sir. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley.
Multiple Grammy Award-winning singer and songwriter Michael Bolton has sold more than 65 million albums worldwide. He has worked with musical icons including Pavarotti, Lady Gaga, and Bob Dylan. He recently starred in the Netflix original show Michael Bolton's Big Sexy Valentine's Day Special. And he has a new album out. It's a collection of movie song covers called Songs of Cinema.
All of our interns know you from
Jack Sparrow.
Yep.
Not from your long hair days, yep. But I know you when you first broke out.
Jack Sparrow.
How did this stuff happen?
The Lonely Island guys who were doing that, you know, they're creating viral videos for Saturday Night Live.
Right.
Asked for a meeting, and we all met in Los Angeles, and my manager and I, and the three of them, and it was so funny sitting across the table. I felt like I knew all of them from their videos.
Sure.
And I said, look, I'm a huge fan. I want to do something with you guys, but the script you sent me, it's too disgusting for me to do. It's hilarious,
yeah.
But not all my fans are going to get what's funny about it.
Right.
And they started laughing. They said, "No, we know. We could tweak it. We could clean it up a little bit."
Yeah.
And I said, "Can you please? I'd love to work with you." And they said, "Well, we really want to do this." And about 7 months later, I was in Atlanta, and I finally got a message from Andy Samberg, and I read it, and I said, "This one I can do."
Yeah.
And they said, "Go to a studio. Find a studio in Atlanta." It did. And then to New York for 2 14-hour days of shooting. We were pretty much laughing nonstop.
I'm sure.
Time, until somebody said, all right, let's call it.
Yeah.
And the most traumatic thing is Erin Brockovich is still very traumatic for me to see myself dressing as her. I need a lot of therapy after that one.
Yeah.
But they had a really good feeling about it, and I was terrified. So when it aired on Saturday Night Live, I was at the studio, mm-hmm. and I found a dark corner by myself, and I just tucked myself into it.
Yeah.
And people started laughing at all the right places. And the next thing I knew, John Mayer was telling me, tomorrow you're going to see something you're not going to believe.
Yeah.
I said, what? He said, whole new audience.
In addition to these videos and the Netflix special, fair to say that Michael Bolton is experiencing a bit of a resurgence, or is that offensive?
No, it's not offensive at all. Okay. I would say it's fair to say.
Yeah.
You could use that. I mean, people are saying it, so that's probably what makes it
true. But do you own it? Do you accept it?
I do. In a way, it's not just a generation. It's two or three generations have discovered me. And then they go on and they look around at your music and they come back to, have you seen this? And they share it. That is a kind of, definitely resurgence is one word.
Yeah.
You know. It's but it's also widened my brand basically, and the ability to do things from a kind of a different platform, which is having fun, which is what I've always loved, and I've always been kind of a joker behind the scenes. I think it's not only acceptable; we're really taking great advantage of, you know, the opportunities and developing television shows, and I was, shortly after Jack Sparrow, I was invited on 2 1/2 Men for multiple episodes, and I thought this could be fun every day. Yeah. You drive to your set, you get into your trailer, and the new funnier pages are there.
Yeah.
And the lines that you asked, you know, if they could be addressed, they're like 10 times as good, and everyone's in stitches, and I look forward to that.
Yeah.
So we're working on a couple of projects that could be a good place to sit down and have my own sitcom.
Yeah.
And connect the music, always keep the music near me. And tour, you know, 5 6 months a year like I do.
Yeah. How have you, speaking of the touring and the long distance runner that you have been in terms of maintaining a following.
I like
and
that.
Touring
long
all
distance
that's what you are, man.
It's a marathon.
Yes, but you are. It's a marathon, man. You've been doing this a long time and you've protected, I want attribution.
That's why you do what you do.
I want attribution. Okay. No. Okay. I'm not the first to say that, trust me. But you've protected your instrument. Yeah. You sound as good now as you did then. How have you done that?
I got invited. One of the most exciting things, a lot of exciting things happen when you have mainstream success.
Yeah.
A lot of doors open. Joe DiMaggio is in your dugout when you're playing a softball game, or people, you know, that you want to be around who are doing great fundraising, great works, all the way to the president.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the White House calls my office and you know, the first couple of times you think it's a practical joke, and then you realize, oh, this is just mainstream success.
Sure.
All the doors open. Now, what do you want to do? Which ones do you want to go through? I got invited to sing with Luciano Pavarotti in the 90s, late 90s. And I immediately started doing my homework and studying what we were going to sing together. And I would listen to him and my eyes would just well up. And I thought, this is a guy who's been doing the right work on his instrument. And I've developed from singing, you know, I was 15 years old, I was doing Chicago blues.
Mm-hmm.
and I had a husky, big voice, but I didn't know that I'm a tenor. I've never really studied the use of the voice in a high C and above high C. So I went to work on my voice and started singing along with Pavarotti. As a kid, singing along with Stevie Wonder was a great way to exercise your voice and become a more flexible singer, because he has the greatest control of his instrument. With Pavarotti, I was developing like a larger engine for the same vehicle, basically. And I learned that the tenors, successful ones, they have their throats wrapped, they're always wearing scarves or multiple layers, they're drinking tea, they're religious about their voices, because when those guys get up on stage, if they don't have the high C, the crowd turns on them. They're coming there for them, but the high C and the big payoff notes, these people all know them, they know the music. So they're under a different kind of pressure and scrutiny.
Yeah.
So they religiously protect their voice. So there's a lot of things I do, but eight hours sleep is the single most important thing for the voice.
You mentioned singing at 15. I was just amazed to go back and preparing for our conversation to look at your journey. You were really signed around 16, but you didn't really break out until you were 34.
Yeah,
you get signed at 16, but you don't break out until you're 34. What's the lesson from that for everyday people?
There are a few.
Yeah.
But the one, because I was off by 18 years, I thought I might have made it when I was 16, and I was off by 18 years.
just a little bit.
But there's something funny about that, and I share that with my audience, and they laugh, and I say, it wasn't funny back then, I assure you.
Yeah.
But just that saying it wasn't funny back then doesn't really sum it all up.
Yeah.
Because I was feeding and helping, provide for a family of five. I had three young daughters. And we didn't want them to know how tough things were. Because eventually we got eviction notices because our rent checks were my rent checks were bouncing. And we didn't have that term homelessness. We didn't have the homeless reference. But looking back, we were really close to being homeless quite a few times. While I had been signed to some of the biggest labels in the world, while I'd been signed as a songwriter for publishing with some of the biggest publishing companies, in between record deals, I never had that huge hit until 87, till That's What Love Is All About came out. I had, fortunately, my songwriting career took off, and that's the portion of the show that I call Food Is Good. So good. You relate to this?
Yeah, I got
everybody,
you.
Everybody
I feel does. You, absolutely.
And then I hear the audience respond, and I just want to make sure they know I am not kidding.
Because
that first hit, Laura Branigan recorded How Am I Supposed to Live Without You?
Absolutely.
And all of a sudden, all the publishers and songwriters in that business were coming to me for the first time, instead of me chasing the industry. And I realized I could have a songwriting career on the side, which was really important because it taught me how important the music is, the songs are, for artists to have long, enduring careers. And so whether I recorded Georgia on My Mind and eventually got to sing it with Ray three times, sang it to him once, which is just so surreal. When a Man Loves a Woman, Percy Sledge classic, I got to sing with him. I don't need to write everything myself. If somebody, someone says, listen to this classic, I think you could make it your own and just have a great time with it. I love doing that, and I learned that I can do that, and I have permission to do that. But as songwriting actually really delivered food and a shelter for my family.
Yeah, I got 2 minutes left, and we've talked about everything but the new project, which I enjoy our conversation. Then there's this, Songs of Cinema. Tell me about this one. Yeah.
So this concept came along. My manager suggested that we look at this possibility, and her name's Christina Klein, and she knows a lot about songwriting, and she's a huge fan. She's been involved in publishing and songwriting for her entire career. Here's a place where you're asking a songwriter, artist, to take a look at a body of work that is in our DNA, that's beloved music from some of the biggest, most iconic films in history, and see if you can find a song in there that you'd love to sing. Well, that was not a problem. And now I'm starting to integrate all the songs into our live show. So every once in a while, you go to a show, you see a band or an artist that you loved, You know there are 24 hits, you know, if they're mm-hmm. fortunate enough to have that. And then at some point during the show, you're going to hear those words. So here's something from my new album, you know, mm-hmm. and everybody goes, oh. Oh, but we just heard seven hits in a row that we were singing when we were kids, or when we got married, when we had children. What's this one now? Or, you know, but everyone's respectful, and you're kind of, you know, rooting for the band. It's like, okay, kill us with this, you know, murder us. And it's not going to have the power and depth most of the time that a song will have after you've heard it hundreds of times, or even 20 times, where you're singing along the melodies and you know every nuance. So one of the things that happens is, and then the next song, they go into one of their greatest hits again, right?
Unless if they're smart.
What have we learned? Don't keep them out there too long.
Exactly.
You, you have to watch your audience and respectfully take their temperature. Mm-hmm. See how they're responding. If you lose them at all, why? You know, fix it or pull that song out of the set. Mm-hmm. But I think this album, Songs of Cinema, allows me to sing some of my favorite music, including a version of When a Man Loves a Woman from mm-hmm. the movie When a Man Loves a Woman, in a way that I had to sit down and I had to make sure that version vocally was worthy to replace my version 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago.
The new project from Michael Bolton is called Songs of Cinema. Michael, it's a joy to have you on the program.
My
I've
pleasure.
Enjoyed our conversation. Come back, we'll do it again.
Thanks so much. You're
my
great.
Pleasure, my pleasure. Friend.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.